Case number 19-2445, United States of America versus Michael Henry. Arguments not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Clark, you may proceed for the appellant.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. I'm Dennis Clark on behalf of Michael Henry. With me at council table is my son-in-law partner, John Clark. And I've reserved 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Yes.
Thank you. The First Step Act should be applied to Appellant Henry's resentencing because his sentence was pending at the time in the district court as defined by the act, and a sentence for his convictions, all six of them, was to be imposed anew after remand. The new law at the time...
Mr. Clark, how do you get to the conclusion that the 924C convictions were pending before the district court, except to the extent that, I mean, the district court could clearly consider those in determining whether to, what sentence to impose in connection with the bank robberies. But how do you get to the conclusion that the 924C charges were pending before the district court?
Well, Your Honor, when the your court, in its opinion in January of 2018, the remand was, and I quote, for the purpose, the limited purpose of resentencing him and allowing the district court to consider the mandatory minimum sentences applicable to him. And when the case came back to the district court from your court, the district court found, made a ruling that the court's remand order did not preclude Henry from raising his First Step Act eligibility at resentencing. So the court could consider the mandatories, consider everything. Also, the court, and this is a specific quote from the district court, implicit in the Sixth Circuit's instruction to resentence defendant in light of Dean is the requirement the court determines the mandatory sentences facing defendant. And then in light of persuasive precedent, the district court further held that since a court must necessarily consider the mandatory minimums applicable to defendant to fully consider its discretion under Dean, the court concludes the defendant can properly raise the issue of his eligibility for relief under First Step.
I'm really not questioning whether the court can consider the First Step Act. I'm really not questioning whether the court could consider the fact that he already had all those mandatory minimum sentences. What I'm really asking you about is the district court. Do you and I have a different view of what the district court was limited to doing on remand? Ultimately, do you disagree that what the district court could do on remand was what it in fact did, which was reduce the bank robbery sentences, taking into account the extremely long amount of time he was going to serve on the 924C charges? You think the district court could have done something more?
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. And what the district court did at the time of sentencing, it imposed a separate sentence for each of the six counts, all six, and then subsequently issued an amended judgment, a written amended judgment, which was, of course, the new sentence, nullifying any prior judgments, any prior sentences, and went ahead and the sentence on all six counts as a result of both the sentencing and the amended judgment is the effective sentence for Mr. Henry today. And it was the sentence anew after the remand.
You use the word anew, but the Sixth Circuit opinion said it was a limited remand as opposed to sentence anew. Is that a significant problem for your position?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because again, the court at a different time in the same opinion said that the remand was for, and I quote at page 501, 722 Fed Appendix 501. The case is being submitted, remanded for the limited purpose of resentencing and allowing the district court to consider the mandatory minimum sentences applicable to him. So that was first of all. Then secondly, the district court made a decision that it was going to independently look at all of these counts. And that's what, in fact, the court did. And
well,
then
we're reviewing the district court. So why don't we get to the language of 403? Because that seems to be the critical language of identifying applicability to pending cases. And that section says that the amendments, which are what you really want to have happen here, shall apply to any offense that was committed before the date of enactment of this act, which is, of course, true here, if a sentence for the offense has not been imposed as of such date of enactment. And so do you have a case or cases that you would rely on to suggest that that language, if a sentence for the offense has not been imposed as of such date of enactment, should apply in the case of a limited remand in light of the Dean case? The Dean case saying that the district court should, or the district court may consider the length of mandatory minimums in deciding the sentence for a separate count.
Yes, Your Honor, I do. The case we cited in our brief and then in a 28J letter, the Seventh Circuit has recently en banc affirmed the district court in Illinois in U.S. versus Uarte. And this case was just decided by the en banc court about a month ago. And let me quote this to answer your question. Section 403, this is a quote direct from the court's opinion. Section 403 is distinct in that it contains a provision that specifically addresses its application to pending cases. Congress took great care to ensure that defendants who had been convicted but not sentenced would not be denied the benefits of Section 403. Congress made crystal clear that 403 reaches all defendants whose sentences had not been imposed before enactment, even those who had been convicted. And finally, the text gives us no reason to believe that Congress excluded from this expansive reach certain defendants awaiting sentencing just because those defendants previously had received invalid sentences.
Was Uriarte a general remand as opposed to a limited remand? And if so, should that make a difference?
I believe it was a general remand, Your Honor, de novo, but I don't think it makes a difference under the circumstances of this case, as I indicated earlier. Furthermore, and on that specific point, Your Honor, there's one more reason why what was done below was appropriate, and that is because of the fact that there was an intervening change in the law. And that's exceedingly important, and this circuit and many others have repeatedly talked about that. One of the opinions that we rely on to answer your specific question, are there other cases out there? We have cited many different cases. We've cited the Jackson case from the Northern District of Ohio, the Crow case from the Eastern District of Michigan, and also this Acosta case from the Western District of New York speaks directly to this, where they quote this court, the Sixth Circuit, in saying the general rule is that a defendant should be sentenced under the law in effect at the time of sentencing. And at the same time, this court has said in U.S. versus Campbell and many other cases that the district court's ruling is consistent here because of an exception to the limitation on any resentencing. And there's a presumption of resentencing, but when there's an intervening change in the law, that can be an exception to any limitation under the law of the case doctrine or a mandate for limited remand. And that's specifically from this court in United States versus Campbell from the Sixth Circuit, 168 Fed Third 263 at pages 265 to 266. Other circuits recognize this rule throughout the country. The Second Circuit specifically, we cite that in our brief. And clearly, that's just another reason why there's really no limitation on this resentencing when it occurred.
Because Congress can, Mr. Clark, Congress can, by the language it's using in a statute, impose something other than what the general rule is, of course, right?
Yes, Your Honor, that could happen. But what we're saying here
let me finish my question, please. Sure. So what we have here is a situation where we're still back to interpreting what Congress said and what Congress meant by a sentence having been imposed, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
I want to ask you one other quick question, okay? And because I don't want to take up too much time. The reason that Judge Cleland reimposed the sentences, in my mind, was because he had to have, at the end of the day, a comprehensive judgment that reflected all of Mr. Henry's convictions. He needed that for purposes of the record, for purposes of the sentence computation, so that the Bureau of Prisons would know what he was in prison for. I mean, that was as much an administrative matter as anything, it seems to me. Do you disagree?
Your Honor, I believe that he was sentencing him anew on all counts. I don't think it was an administrative matter. Respectfully, I believe that the reasoning of Urarte and the other cases cited, specifically this Urarte case, goes on to talk about how the only case that is against us, and it really isn't because it's so distinguishable, is this U.S. versus Hodge case. And Urarte says that when Hodge talks about the specific language of 403, they're saying that it's what their discussion is pure dicta. Because what happened in Hodge, again, the only case that's cited against us, it's so different because Hodge was convicted on 3 federal counts and 7 territorial counts because the case came out of the District Court of the Virgin Islands. And what the Third Circuit said, we're sending this case back for the limited resentencing on the territorial counts, not even the federal counts. So the Hodge case is totally different for those reasons. First of all, because of what I just said, and secondly, because what Urarte says about Hodge is what they said about 403 is pure dicta. And I see my time is up, so I'll be back for rebuttal.
Yes, definitely. Mr. Mulcahy?
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Kevin Mulcahy, and I represent the United States in this case. This court should affirm the district court's judgment for 2 separate but equally strong reasons. The first is that when this court remanded the case back to Judge Cleland at the district court, it did so through a limited remand. After Henry's second appeal, the court affirmed all of his convictions and the sentences related to his Section 924C crimes. What remained was this intervening Supreme Court case of Dean, which allowed the district court to consider mandatory minimum sentences under 924C when sentencing on the predicate offenses, in this case, bank robberies. And so this court concluded the very last sentence of this second Henry appeal, stating the narrow remand as, quote, for the limited purpose of resentencing Henry in light of Dean. So this court used the term limited twice in its opinion. As a result, the district court should not even have entertained the applicability of the First Step Act on remand.
The essence of the Dean case is that the length of mandatory minimums can be considered by a district court in deciding what the length of the non-mandatory minimum counts could be. And so why shouldn't it be proper for a district court to consider under the new First Step Act what the length of the mandatory minimums should be as part of a limited remand? So it's not like the district court is going off to decide some sentencing enhancement on some other matter, but it's something that's tied directly to what the remand is for.
Your Honor, I agree that it's tied to something that the remand was for, but the district court was not permitted under the scope of the remand to change those 924C sentences. And so while I agree that the district court had to consider the length of time that 924C required, it was wholly without authority to alter or change the 924C. It could only view it as an influencer, if it viewed it as an influencer at all, for the bank robbery convictions, excuse me, sentence.
If this had been a general remand, would you allow the district judge to reduce the mandatory minimums pursuant to the First Step Act?
No, Your Honor. The government would not be able to obviously make this argument, this limited remand argument, but under the plain language of the statute, Mr. Henry still does not get the benefit of the First Step Act.
So I find that, I'm sorry, Judge Moore.
Oh, please.
You think you were, no.
I was going to say, you're taking the position of the dissent in the en banc in Uriarte, which clearly raised this issue, as opposed to the majority in the en banc in the Seventh Circuit.
Yes, Your Honor.
Judge Gibbons.
Mr. Mulcahy, your position, the government's position on that point seems to be that even if a sentence is vacated and remanded, it's still imposed because at some point a prior sentence had been in effect. I mean, it seems to me that a sentence that is, when the conviction is vacated and the case is remanded, which I agree didn't happen here, but if in a case where that happened, how do you contend that the sentence has been imposed? I mean, that just seems, there's no longer a sentence. It's been vacated. It seems to me that that's a really hard and unnecessary argument for the government to make, convincingly.
So I'll start with that, perhaps that last point first, which is to say, in this case, Your Honor is absolutely right. This court does not need to reach that issue because of the limited nature of the remand. But comparing Uriarte to Hodge, which is the Third Circuit case, which stands procedurally in the same place as both Uriarte and Mr. Henry's case here, to suggest that a sentence that's been vacated never took place is very different than to say that a new sentence must be imposed. Congress chose to use the phrase a sentence imposed rather than a final sentence. Had it chosen the words final sentence, certainly Mr. Henry would be victorious here, as would several of the other defendants.
You think that Congress intended to strip appellate courts of their ability to vacate sentences and to make an imposed sentence unimposed?
No, not I don't think Congress was trying to strip the appellate courts of any of its right, but rather—
Isn't that what your argument would do?
No, Your Honor. Our argument would simply recognize the historical fact that a sentence had been imposed. Congress had the difficult job of drawing lines here. And where Congress chose to draw the line in this case was to say, anyone who commits a 924C crimes, multiple 924C crimes in the same indictment moving forward will get the benefit of the act. And anyone who committed that crime so close in time that they had not yet been sentenced would also receive the benefit of the act. But for others who had been sentenced, the act won't apply to them. And Congress drew that line, whether it's the right line to draw or the line that the group of us, if we were a five-person panel to create it, would have drawn, is different than whether Congress drew a clear line. And in this case, it did draw the clear line there. And the government's position is merely asking the court to apply that plain language.
Well, the Seventh Circuit takes the opposite position from the Third Circuit in Hodge. And the Seventh Circuit indicates that a sentence imposed in a general remand, at least, should be interpreted to require that there be a valid sentence, shall we say. There's a question, if we say there's ambiguity because of the two different circuits reaching different conclusions, is there legislative history or commentary from members of Congress that would support or reject your position?
So to answer Your Honor's question, I don't have that information in front of me. I don't believe that there is, and I didn't cite any in our brief. However,
there's an amicus brief in the Ninth Circuit where several different members of Congress of both parties have taken the position that your interpretation is wrong.
So the strength of that argument would, of course, depend on whether or not the plain language of the act is ambiguous. And our contention is that the words imposed have a accepted meaning, and a sentence versus the sentence or final sentence suggests that Congress meant to draw the line at a sentence imposed as a historical fact rather than requiring or rather than acknowledging that some sentences may be vacated by courts of appeals or otherwise. Importantly, I think that when we're talking about Uriarte versus Hodge, there is an important distinction that matters for Mr. Henry here, which is that in Uriarte, it was a general remand. And in the Hodge case of the Third Circuit, it was, as Mr. Henry's is, a limited remand. So because both of those, Mr. Hodge and Mr. Henry, sit procedurally in the same place in that they were being sentenced after passage of the act, but after a limited remand, this case is more akin to Hodge than it is to Uriarte.
But your opponent has argued that Hodge was a different kind of limited remand because it was limited to these territorial counts, whereas the remand here is a remand to resentence in light of Dean, which directly addresses the fact of mandatory minimum sentences. So isn't there sort of an intermediate position where one could say that a limited remand in light of Dean is more like a general remand for purposes of this narrow situation?
So in fact, I think the opposite would be true, that it is more like Hodge than it is like Uriarte. What the Hodge court in its initial remand told the district court was, as far as the federal sentences go, leave those be and only focus on these territorial offenses. Similarly, what this court said in second...
Could I ask you a question?
Sure. Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Do you agree that there is just a split in the circuits on this question? The circuits are just have different outcomes and basically all the same kind of facts, right?
I think there's one distinguishing fact between Uriarte and Hodge, which is the limited scope of the remand. But otherwise, procedurally, I agree with Your Honor that there is a split from the Seventh Circuit reasoning and the Third Circuit reasoning.
So the only way that's going to be worked out is for the Supreme Court to take cert of one of these cases and straighten it out, right?
Yes, Your Honor. To the extent that another circuit weighs in finding a case that doesn't have a limited remand, that approves of the government's view of this law without a limited remand, where Hodge and Uriarte are different is the limited remand, and because Mr. Henry is much more like Mr. Hodge, and that this case had a limited remand as well, there is that distinction. And turning back, Judge Moore, to your question, shouldn't this be a situation where if it's a limited remand in light of Dean, it's more like Uriarte. Just as the Third Circuit had indicated to the district court in Hodge, leave the federal sentences alone and focus only on the territorial offenses. This court's remand in the second Henry case said, leave the 924C convictions and sentences alone and look only to the bank robberies, because it was the bank robbery that are at issue.
To say that the Sixth Circuit said leave the 924C sentences alone, it didn't expressly say that. And of course, the Sixth Circuit decision was before the First Step Act, right?
Yes, Your Honor. Absolutely.
So
I meant that.
The Sixth Circuit decision didn't even know about the change that the First Step Act would provide. So it wouldn't have been possible for the Sixth Circuit to remand in light of the First Step Act.
Right. Correct. Yes, Your Honor. And that's true also of Hodge, where the Third Circuit couldn't have known when it remanded, because again, it remanded before the passage of the act as well. But to sort of put a cap on this limited remand issue as it relates to Mr. Hodge. While I agree that this court limited remand did ask the district court to issue a new judgment and issue a new, it could only change the sentence as it related to the predicate bank robberies. Those 924C crimes, those sentences were static. And that's what makes this more like Hodge and less like the general remand of Uriarte. And so, unless there are further questions, the government would submit simply that there is a plain language of the act certainly supports Judge Cleland's decision below. But before the court even needed to weigh in on the plain language of the act, the limited nature of the remand left the district court without authority to do what Mr. Henry asked it to do, and therefore this court should affirm the judgment and the sentences.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Clark.
Thank you, Your Honor. A few things to mention. First of all, in regard to the, I just want to mention that the ruling by the court below was never cross-appealed by the government. Secondly, in regard to the Hodge case, as I pointed out, I know I'm emphasizing this, but the facts are so totally different and the remand was so totally different. And the actual what may pertain to the decision rendered to be rendered by this court is as the Seventh Circuit said, dicta in Uriarte. Thirdly, as far as the, I think it's very important, the law is so clear on this, that in this circuit and throughout the country, that when there is an intervening change in the law, that can be taken into effect or taken into consideration by the district court, and particularly here on a resentencing, when there's an intervening change in the law, that could be properly taken into consideration. And indeed, it was by the district court. And finally, I just want to also mention that, again, the Sixth Circuit, when you did remand originally, it was remanded for resentencing and consideration of the mandatories. And finally, and I think this is really very, very important at this point, because of the back and forth on this and the discussion about what the law says and how it applies, I'm suggesting and strongly urging that the rule of lenity be applied in this particular case. To the extent that there's the applicability of the First Step Act to pending cases could be considered ambiguous at any point as to resentencings, the rule of lenity should apply. It's very interesting. We've heard quite a bit about, we've heard the name and the philosophy recently of Justice Scalia. He was a proponent of this rule of lenity, and there are a number of Supreme Court cases in recent years that have cited the rule of lenity. And also, this Sixth Circuit has many times, and I mean, we've quoted them in our cases, U.S. versus Bucha for a number, for example, from the Sixth Circuit in 2001. The policy of lenity means the court will not interpret a federal statute so to increase the penalty as it places on an individual when such an interpretation can be no more than a guess as to what Congress intended. And also, specifically, the U.S. versus Rocky Moore from the Sixth Circuit at 909 Fed Third, it's only from 2018, they also talk about the rule of lenity and the number of Supreme Court cases, and specifically some reasoning by Judge Scalia. This seems to be the classic textbook case for the application of the rule of lenity. Thank you.
Thank you both for your argument. Mr. Clark, I see that you're appointed pursuant to the Criminal Justice Act, and we thank you for your representation of your client.
You're welcome.
You both for the argument, and the case will be submitted.